Good afternoon, everybody. The arc of publishing is my topic today. I'm going to be talking about where publishing's going, what works, and how it's getting, and how we're going to move there. I work for Copyright Clearance Center. I've been there for 15 years. I've been in as a technologist. I've designed databases that hold tens of millions of rights for mass clearance of works across the publishing spectrum. I've designed DRM applications, and I've also written a couple novels. So I do a lot of things involved in publishing. I've been involved in the industry for a long time. So when I talk about the arc of publishing, what I'm talking about is predicting the future, and that's really hard, right? People get the future wrong all the time. In fact, I bet that soon people won't even try to predict the future anymore. Think about it. But some futures are very predictable. An advanced reader's copy, one kind of arc, is a prediction of the future with extremely good foreknowledge. It's what the real book is going to look like. It's easy to predict the future when you know what's coming. It's like I'm throwing a ball to myself. If I throw the ball, it curves to the air, I know how to catch it. But that's not something I always knew, right? That's something we have to learn. It's, you know, you throw a ball at a baby, you're lucky if it even moves its head. But when we learn the rule, we can predict the future well enough to be able to catch the ball pretty easily. Most futures aren't that controlled, so the most we can hope for is that they're like a ball that someone else has thrown. If we see where it starts, we can see it in flight, we get an idea where it's going. With that in mind, let me ask, does the future of publishing have a predictable arc? Does this kind of curve look familiar to anyone out here? It's the S-curve of growth over time as described by Clay Christensen in his book, The Innovator's Dilemma. We see over there at the left an early period of slow growth before a new model takes hold. Then a new model takes over, and we have a period of extremely rapid growth as a new entrant becomes a dominant player in a new market. Then, as the market matures, finally, we see growth leveling off. This is a pattern typical of disruptive innovation in which companies succeed by tearing apart the market as it existed before and promoting a new one. So where does the dilemma come in? Why does Clay Christensen call it a dilemma? And the problem is that when you're one of those companies up there on the far right, it's nearly impossible for you to recover the kind of earth-shaking of innovation to kind of adopt the new models that are how you get to that period of rapid growth again. Let me give an example. Say you have $1 million because you're a big, mature organization, and you're trying to decide between starting an earth-shattering new invention in which you might spend 2 years trying to find new customers, figure out whether it works, and at the end of that point in time, you might have zero return on that $1 million. Or you could spend that $1 million building a new sales office in the Southeast region. It's obviously a better decision to go and build the sales office in the Southeast region because you'll get a measurable, predictable return from it until the model changes entirely and you can't sell anything anymore. The book Innovator's Dilemma shows dozens of examples of this behavior in wildly different industries, from steam shovels to disk drives. But here's a more recent example that hits a little closer to home. This is one of the big dot-com darlings, still a going concern with billions in revenue today. You see, just out of the book, an initial period of flat growth before the new model takes hold, then a stunning period in which revenue increases by fourfold over a mere 3 or 4 years. Then we have a peak around 07 and then a gradual tapering off. Any guesses? Well, it's Yahoo. And it must be said, I think Yahoo will be fortunate to get back to the revenue of 2007, let alone to surpass it. So what happened? As it turned out, they got whacked by a disruptive innovator. And Yahoo's meteoric growth looks pretty flat compared to the tenfold revenue growth of a player that entered just a little after they did. Never has a company's name seemed more ironic than at the bottom of this page. So what is Yahoo's business? Yahoo has portals. Yahoo has, you know, they were one of the earliest internet radio providers. And their business from day one has always been to get people to come to their site so they could show them ads that they had sold. Now, Yahoo's ad model, although it was on the internet, wasn't at all that dissimilar from ad models that prevailed for ages and ages and ages. Yahoo's ads were display ads, you know, which used to be little rectangles. Now they're the squares, and, you know, they have animation or movies or maybe even a game to show on them. And they were sold through a fairly high-contact sales process to larger corporations with a higher price to get in, larger campaigns, and a longer commitment. So who is the innovator that completely destroyed the advertising model on the internet? And, of course, we all know it's Google. But what do? Google actually bought a company that had this fledgling, not-too-successful advertising model that they renamed AdWords. If you're a search engine, this is a great model. You could, because it's about playing placing ads against things that people search on. Google didn't just take the technology, though. They applied a new business model to it. These are not very impressive ads. They're just words on a page with a link. So they said, we're not going to try to get thousands of dollars or hundreds of dollars or even tens of dollars per impression. They created a bidding model that allowed anybody to buy placements against their chosen terms so you could get into advertising on Google with a budget of just a few dollars. Then they turned that around and allowed ads sold through this process to be hosted on any website through a modification of that called AdSense. You can tell a lot of different stories about how Yahoo lost its way, but Google's disruption of the online ad market, which impacted Yahoo's revenue directly, has to be at the center. So this is also the story of the news business, by the way, despite the fact that Google publishes virtually no content of its own outside the company blogs. Because what business are newspapers in, after all? Advertising. One way to look at it is that newspapers, if you're their customer, are selling you to the people who buy their ads. Advertisers historically valued this access so highly, they paid enough of it to support a fairly large amount of variably altruistic journalism. Macy's never wanted to send war correspondents to Europe in World War II or Vietnam in the 60s or even Iraq in the 90s, but they were willing to pay enough historically that the New York Times and every other newspaper could afford to do so. So even though, but what happened here is that, you know, the web made it very easy and cheap to get new content out where anybody could look at it. And then Google and a few other companies learned how to turn all that new cheap content into ad inventory. Cheaper to get into, new people could buy ads. So that even though no new news mega giant has appeared to replace the ostensible function of news publishing, we can see that the news business was again disrupted from below. And the numbers back it up. These are all from the U.S. Census Department, their self-reported numbers. We can see this huge tail off in news revenue starting about 2005. And was this ad revenue? Well, yes, it was ad revenue, because we can see that even through the end of 2009, newspaper subscription revenue has been holding steady. And who would have believed that? But ad revenue has fallen off a cliff. And this also shows you that newspaper business is all about ads. It's the same in mass market periodicals. We see that the revenue from subscriptions hasn't been tailing off nearly as fast as the revenue from ads. If we add book publishing, though, we see a different story. Throughout the period of the news industry's decline, and indeed throughout the horrible economy the last couple of years, the book publishing industry, and this is trade publishing by and large, has remained remarkably, even eerily steady. It's nice not to have a dependency on the ad model when advertising is getting blown up all around you, isn't it? On the other hand, though, here's another way to look at it. During that same period of time, the population of the United States has increased by 30 million people, or 10%, while book publishing has remained eerily steady again. That's not the best trend. So that's the arc of the innovator, and it repeats again and again. Yesterday's hot new innovator becomes today's industry leader and eventually becomes next year's stumbling dinosaur. The real problem is what happens to you after your market is disrupted. It's not good. The reason it's hard to see Yahoo growing its revenue beyond 2007's peak is that the whole game of online advertising, their business, has changed around them. The customers that they were good at selling at before have moved on, either to the new model and buying keywords on Google, or they're buying display ads from Google too, because Google used the enormous wads of cash that it was taking in from that low-margin business to move up the value chain to capture those high-margin customers as well. It's a lot easier to predict Yahoo entering a severe decline at this point than it is to see them resuming their growth. The path that got them here won't work again. They need a lot more money than a lot of small customers flowing into a tiny new business can make for them. The internet property that they've given up on, search, is now owned by Google. So who is Google worried about themselves? It's certainly not Bing, and it's certainly not, well, Yahoo, which is also Bing. It's Facebook. Because that has a Facebook's business is, again, selling you to their advertisers. Same as Google, same as newspapers before them. And Facebook can probably do that at a much lower cost per page than Google can. So let's review the core characteristics of market disruption in slightly more detail. You start with a stable market. You have dominant players with well-established value chains. You have new technology entering that market that has the potential to deliver a similar service. And because it's different, one of the things it can do is allows you to serve different customers who deliver lower margins than those bigger established companies can afford to sell to. In fact, they're taking up business that the dominant player doesn't even want, that they're walking away from. We can't worry about those guys. So then you mix the two together. You have new providers entering the market using new technology to serve new customers and move up the value chain for higher margins. Does that sound anything like the state of publishing today? Well, let's go point by point. We certainly have dominant players with well-established value chains. Some of these companies can write histories of themselves that stretch back hundreds of years. But behind the big six, you have literally tens of thousands of smaller and independent publishers, and it's quite likely that every single one of them is trying to figure out how to win at ebooks, for instance, in one way or another. And the most obvious new technology that springs to mind is the ebook marketplace. So you've got new technology, similar service, books, ebooks. Only one letter difference, right? You certainly do have lower margins, right? Because ebook prices are way lower than the prices we're used to from print before. I saw a tweet from another conference earlier today that where an analyst was saying that the average ebook sale price was like $7 or so. And an average print book sale price was over like $12. Is there a $5 difference in production costs per title to bring a book to the Kindle or whatever for a publisher than paper? Probably not. So that, you know, that's where your lower margins come from. I think the margins will look substantially lower. So are the customers different, though? Does anybody think that the people who are buying these e-readers to read books on them are people who would not have read books before? So if I'm a book a year guy, and there are a lot of book a year guys out there, am I buying a Kindle to make it easier for me to read my one book a year? Probably not. So let's hold on to that. So that's disruptive change in a little nutshell, but it's not the only kind of change we see in the marketplace. There's change every day. Publishers start new imprints, shutter old ones. Up through a couple years ago, vampire books were totally hot. And now it's vampire movies instead. In the dawn of the ebook age, we have to wonder what kind of arc we're in. Is it an arc of disruption, or is it just one of the natural motions of a business adjusting to new entrants? To figure that out, we first have to look backward a little way to see where the movement started. Everybody remember the ebook war? If you blinked, you might have missed it. January 29, 2010, Amazon delists all Macmillan titles, ebooks and print, as part of a fairly hardball negotiating strategy trying to fight off a request by Macmillan. They're going to stand up there and hold solid for the benefit of their customers and the sacred $9.99 ebook price point. Until January 31, a couple days later, when they announced they're going to put Macmillan all back up. Took them a little longer than that. It might have taken more than a week in some cases to get all those buy buttons back up. the extent that Amazon Macmillan recently announced they're going to try to make their authors whole from the lost sales during that week. Because Amazon they were playing hardball with Macmillan, but what the people they wound up really irritating were the authors and their readers. And authors were able to mobilize their readers to a degree that probably wasn't possible in the 60s or the 70s or whatever. So why am I pointing to this where the movement started? It has to do with the changing sales model for e-books. If we go all the way back, 2009. Early days, ancient days, dinosaurs roaming the earth. I got these numbers from a New York Times article early in 2010. $26 hardcover bestseller. Half goes to the retailer, half goes back to the publisher. You've got some fixed costs over there to the left. You know, their numbers were maybe less than a buck for designing the book. You know, averaged out over a print run, maybe a dollar averaged out over the print run for marketing. Then you have the floating costs like printing, storing, shipping, returns, and then you have the author royalty and the publisher net. You know, like you know, very close to each other, very similar shares of the sale. And if you change the actual numbers around, this chart probably remains pretty ballpark accurate for decades. Amazon at that time sold every Kindle book for $9.99, strange as that may seem today, and it was on a 65-35 royalty share, where they kept the 65. So that looks the economics of this are completely different. If the publisher's taking home $3.38 from a $9.99 sale and has those 80-cent dollar or so marketing costs, they have to pay the author. Publisher's not going to make any money on that, so you know they. They didn't do the design. They didn't do the marketing. You know, so you had very poor-looking e-book editions back then, and you had no marketing to speak of. It was piggybacking on whatever they did for the paper. Obviously, this would seem like a strong motivation to delay the introduction of the e-book of the digital edition to capture profits from those higher revenue formats first, more like a very unprofitable paperback. So what happened right around the beginning of 2010? Apple, and not just Apple, but it's Apple's willingness to entertain the agency model, in which publishers are able to set prices, the seller acts as an agent for the sale rather than as a retailer, and it's a 70-30 split, but this time the publishers keep the 70. One of the earliest leaks of information about the iPad was one that says not only is there going to be an iPad, they're going to have a bookstore and do the agency model. And this is publishers working with Apple behind the scenes pre-launch. An agency sale looks completely different from that retail model ebook. Publisher net is, you know, of a $12.99 ebook is, you know, almost $7. The retailer is, you know, still making money on that, and the author's doing. Yeah, the author's getting $2.27 out of that $12.99. One of the signal differences here is that although the shares are certainly better than they were in the $9.99 ebook, that the publisher share and the author share are no longer very similar. The publisher's able to keep a lot more of this according to the prevailing royalty model. So it's no wonder. And that Amazon chose to push back on this model, since they were losing the benefit of that 65 share they were getting before. They did give in, and by now all of the big six now employ the agency model at least some of the time, and Random House is the last to join. But there's a twist on how Amazon implemented it, because they also opened this market open to everybody who wants to upload a book. Pardon me, and. But if you're not one of the publishers they have a special agency deal with, to get that 70-30 share, you have to price between $2.99 and $9.99. And the price must be equal to the lowest available on any platform. And these are important provisions that continue Amazon's overall strategy of pushing book prices down to the lowest possible that their providers will tolerate. Amazon's move here created a new value chain. It wasn't just like the publisher to the e-tailer to the reader anymore. So think about new providers using new technology to serve new customers. Amazon's not the new customer for Amazon and the other e-tailers isn't the reader. It's the author. They're offering a publishing service and access to a market to existing customers of the dominant players at a much better price. So this has given us rise to a new phenomenon never seen before, I think, in the history of publishing, the successful self-published author. So if we dig into this, we can call it the author scenario. The thrilling tale of the brave men and women who strike out for the great unknown, turning their backs on the three-book deal and the end cap at Barnes & Noble for the uncertain promise of higher royalty rates from e-book retailers. So it's about cutting out the middleman with the publisher as the middleman. And I'm sure publishers, over centuries, have not thought of themselves as being the middleman. There's a very vocal proponent of this model, a successful thriller suspense author named Joe Conrath, who also writes as Jack Kilbourne. Now, he wasn't a Kindle native author. He didn't get his start there. He went the traditional route. Had a standard, actually pretty good mid-list deal, 3-book, 6-figure, and he's blogged his progress for a year, and nobody has ever, as far as we know, worked harder at promoting his works through the standard channel. Authors in the audience, think about making 500 bookstore visits in 55 days. He did that. I think he says he did over 1,200 by the time he stopped doing that. But now, He publishes his new work and his backlist to the Kindle, and only on the Kindle and the other e-tailers. In January, he says he made more in that 1 month than he made from his third novel, Rusty Nail, in 5 years from all channels: hardcover, paperback, foreign rights, translation, everything together. So that's a powerful story. As you can see, one of the things that works for him is a lower price and that 70% cut that he gets. But he's not the only one doing this, and a number of authors that you may or may not have heard of have enjoyed success to a greater or lesser degree. Let's look at some of the common factors we see in these authors who have experienced this success. First of all, they're pretty good authors. Their work is solid, professional for the most part. They're not the slush that you do see in that stop. They also, a lot of them, have literary agents, and that's sort of the Matrix style of literary agent, I guess. And what does an agent do? There are a lot of things that an agent can still do. If you were here in the room the last time, we had an agent from the Andrea Brown Agency talk about how one of her authors wasn't getting a real book deal, but so they helped launch that author as a Kindle author, and that's a very interesting approach. There's also contracts, more complicated, more subtle differences from prior contracts. Authors aren't good at everything, especially contracts. So another thing all of these authors have in common is that they're all genre fiction. They write thrillers, they write romance, they write science fiction, urban fantasy, things like that. Of course, these are the most popular sections of fiction, particularly romance. I think you also have people who are readers who are more open to authors they've never heard of before, because I know it's a romance. It's got the right cover. I know it's a thriller. It's got a gun on front of it. And finally, of course, there is price. I mentioned this a minute ago. All of these authors, without exception, publish their works well below the original $9.99 threshold, the top end of what Amazon will allow them to charge, and which is, of course, well below the $12.99, $14.99, $15.99 that publishers are releasing the major author titles at. But what's interesting is that many of these authors who have been successful with these lower prices have found that there is movement in both directions. If you go down too low and keep it there, that's some kind of quality signal in which your work just looks like it's part of the masses. Whereas at the $2.99, $3.99, $4.99, you're in the middle of what most of the most popular authors are using. Interesting, though, how much of the success of these authors is just that they're cheaper than Lauren Hillenbrand, James Patterson, and so on? Does this hold up over time as this generation of author gets famous? Does it affect prices as a whole throughout the industry? This is something we all have to be very concerned about. One thing that's very interesting, though, and I don't think many of the authors acknowledge this, is the first-mover advantage that all of them are enjoying. By definition, they're all early starters. That's one way that price helps them, because you're more willing to go to someone you've never heard of if it's one-third the investment. One of the authors that Joe Conrath talks about benefited from being the first urban fantasy author available on the Nook, which meant that she went right up to the top of the urban fantasy bestseller list on the Nook. And that proved a huge promotional benefit for her, and because she was good at it, her books were good, she managed to hold on to that, onto high rankings, and sells tens of thousands of units a month. You can't discount this first mover advantage effect. It's exactly what Gladwell talks about in Outliers, where if you're good at what you do and you hit a new market at exactly the right time, you have a huge advantage over people who tried too early. And that advantage will evaporate, so the people who come after you may never be able to achieve the same kind of sudden success. So where does all this go? Because I've read articles in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, all over the place on this scenario, this author direct scenario. But most of the discussions I see treat this as an end state. So you have this, centuries-old multi-level market with sophisticated, powerful players with tremendous revenue today, transforming organically over a couple of years into a single-level market with a massive, essentially individual contractors selling their wares to two, maybe three or four highly technical retailers, and that it stays that way. I find that inconceivable. There's another movement that's going to come into play that's going to shake that up as well. So let's look at some of the pressures that would develop in this unstable market. Say you have a almost successful Kindle author, doing almost okay, wishing she could do better. Let's have a couple more, because there'll sure be plenty of them. Individually, they're just scraping by, but if they join forces, they might be able to hire someone to help them out. Maybe a cover artist, one with experience for designing Amazon-style thumbnails. It's a big difference. Traditional books are designed to look great and stand out from across the room. And then when you shrink it down into an inch and a half by an inch, it looks like a muddy thing, maybe clashing fluorescent colors, and you can't read anything. So the cover artist is willing to work for the three of them, maybe at a lower rate, because he's getting three jobs at once instead of one. Probably there's a freelance editor looking for work, because authors need editors, and signs it to work with a couple of them for a fee or for some royalty points. And so things start to pick up. As a group, they start to get occasional mentions in high-traffic blogs or whatever that talk about books a lot, like Whatever or Boing Boing or The All. And sales really pick up after one of those. And they realize they could do even better if they had someone working on promotion more often. And all of a sudden, you got a publisher. Because every author, for that matter, every person, isn't good at every task in any value chain, let alone publishing. There are structural advantages in collaboration. It's why corporations form in the first place. It's cheaper to hire an artist or an editor or promoter to work for do a bunch of jobs at the same time than to hire like three artists to make one cover each. It's another natural arc of business, the arc of consolidation. It's a movement that's driven by transactional costs and relationships, and it's happened in every healthy marketplace since we started to be able to pay attention to such things. That won't be the only one. Over time, more and more of those appear. And it doesn't have to be that sort of organic, let's raise a barn together and hold a concert kind of consolidation I just talked to right there. You'll have venture-funded startups trying to provide new. You've already got them, and you've got Smashwords, you've got Fast Pencil, you've got some... StoryPlan was a new kind of publisher that was just talked about at the last panel. They're stepping in to provide services from the publishing value chain. Maybe they're trying to do the whole value chain. Maybe they are just doing a piece of it. Maybe, who knows, maybe a really enterprising startup with a financial bent might start to offer authors loans against future royalties and then call them advances. Not quite the same thing. Maybe a few of these organizations consolidate as well, just so they can handle more authors or cut better deals with the retailers. Authors start wanting to belong to these organizations, so they're outside banging on the glass. If you're the guy in the middle, guy or whatever in the middle, you have to be selective. You can't offer the full credit, the full brand, the full power of the organization to every guy who writes a book about his goldfish. So what's the difference between this and a publisher? You've got gatekeeping, you've got overhead, you've got relationship management. Well, one thing to pay attention to is that I haven't mentioned anything so far that would cause this organization to purchase rights from the author and hang on to them for a while. But you could see that too. If you put the full force of your brand, your credibility, your relationships behind an author, you're going to want some kind of payback over time. And you can imagine, after a while, it could get pretty hard for an author without the advantages of these kind of publishers. You could still list your works with Amazon or whatever, but the kind of valuable promotional space that really drives sales is going to be harder to come by. Can you see the two indies? Here, it's pretty crowded. Larger organizations naturally develop better relationships with the retailers. It's easier for the retailer to work with a huge group as a single unit rather than as a bunch of individuals. The deal that Macmillan gets with Amazon is different from the deal that Joe Conrath does, although Joe Conrath is pretty special to Amazon right now. So some of these organizations could be very well these same organizations that we are familiar with today. An earlier panel I saw tweeted a lot. They were asked, what percentage of the big six will be around in 5 years? Two of the three panelists guessed 50%. And the other one guessed 100%, but half of them will own the other half. But there's another force that we haven't talked about yet, and that's competition. Let's focus on those little guys down along the bottom border of the slide. The e-tailers. These proportions are all wrong, though. If you're looking at trade publishing as a whole, it's something like this. Amazon.com, and it's 25%. Somewhere between 22-28%. I've seen different numbers. Barnes & Noble slightly less than that today. And looking at trade publishing as a whole, Apple barely figures, Google barely figures. Has anybody bought a book from the Google eBook store yet? Data point. If we look at eBook publishing only, though, it's more like this. I've seen throughout this year numbers for Amazon of around 80%. Somebody was saying it was around 65% earlier, but I'd be a little surprised at that. Apple, the other guys are basically bit players at this point, despite the holiday success of the Nook, the launch of the iPad, and it's apparently they claim a million unit sales in their first year. And again, Google eBook store. If we add the publishers of this, based on market cap, it's more like this. Amazon is a way, way, way bigger company than any major publisher. Saw a stat earlier today that the entire publishing industry was around $60 billion in revenue, which is, order of magnitude what Apple does. So these are very big companies that have a lot of power of their own. Now, in the specific domain of ebook publishing, publishers were able to win the ebook war against Amazon because they had what Amazon needed, the titles that they needed to sell. Publishers are still strong. They swing a lot of weight in publishing. Well, hence the name, publishers. But if they were severely weakened relative to Amazon, Amazon would have no reason to leave so much money on the table with its authors. In a hypothetical world where most of Amazon's book sales came from independent authors, not through publishing deals, Amazon would have no reason at all to maintain the 70-30 royalty split. So that's one arc, the consolidation competition affecting that arc of disruptive innovation. But this is typical in these scenarios. It's not actually a really bad thing to be one of those wealthy, high-revenue, powerful companies at the far right hand of the graph. It's what every company aspires to have revenue, power, relationships. So although this period of disruption can be a tough scenario for publishers, I'm not at all convinced it's game over. Publishers can still compete with it. The canonical advantages of the mature company are revenue and resources and other resources. So if there's a contest, if there's a battle that comes down to that, that money and relationships can win for you, those little guys at the left-hand side are not going to win. The big companies win those every time. So big publishers will use, and we'll see this continuing, to their financial resources to win and retain their star authors. They might even have a chance at a best case. How many people talk about best cases for publishing these days? Where the digital-only market functions as a kind of minor league, where authors develop off-publisher payrolls and migrate to big publishers only as they become reliable sellers. So here's another curve. It's author revenue against the number of authors. What does this mean? Well, it means that at the left-hand side, we have a very small number of very successful authors who deliver huge revenue to their publishers. You know their names, Stephanie Meyer, J.K. Rowling, James Patterson, all of those people. And in fact, those authors make so much money for their publishers that when Stephanie Meyer has trouble figuring out what the next vampire book is going to be, Hachette has to mention it on their financial filings. It's a material impact if there's no new vampire book this year. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So naturally, there are a lot more authors with very little revenue. And actually, this looks like it's the standard asymptotic curve, but if you add in traditional vanity publishing where the author's paying to be published, that line goes below the x-axis. There are authors who function year after year at a net loss. So publishers have to spend money to bring books to market. You know, think about formatting. Do I go EPUB? Do I again key in my own metadata? Do I do paper? You know, all that stuff. And they also have to pay authors. So over at the right-hand side, you have authors who don't earn back their advances, let alone the cost of bringing them to market. There's a loss. Here's the revenue left over. That's the green. And it's heavily weighted toward the left. So this means, as I was saying, that if you lost that right-hand side of the tail, it wouldn't be a bad thing. Your returns are better. You're making more money. You're more profitable. In fact, even if you lose a few of your solid mid-list entries, it's not game over. It's a real challenge, but you can continue to work with that. It's when you lose the top end of the curve, the left-hand side of the graph, the big-ticket authors, if they start to go over, that really leaves a mark. There's a real challenge there. So next question, how's that looking so far? Let's read that classic, A Tale of Two Authors. The first author is Barry Eisler, award-winning author of 8 thriller novels since 2003, a solid mid-list author, maybe on the upper end of the mid-list. 8 books in 8 years, all of them good sellers. He's getting movie rights sales. This is a Japanese language movie, but Gary Oldman. And so he's doing well. Second author is Amanda Hocking. I hear her name here a lot today. She has self-published 9 novels on the Kindle since January 2010. Estimated sales in January 2011 alone, remember, January 2009, she didn't have anything out yet, 450,000 units, not dollars, units. And she tried for years to find a publisher through the traditional route. And she apparently has another 8 books in her desk. So why do I care about these? Why am I comparing these two? Because within a couple of days of each other, in March of this year, they both made major announcements. Barry, on March 21st, turned down a $500,000 2-book deal from St. Martin's Press. Amanda, on March 24th, signed a $2 million 4-book deal with St. Martin's Press. That must have been a hell of a week in those offices. So Barry had a very nuts and bolts, business-oriented, return on investment approach to the decision he made. He identified a break-even point around 2014, 2015, and where he would have made more money under the old deal, but by owning his own rights, having the bigger return on just the digital stuff, he would have made it back. So, solid, savvy, marketing-based decision. Amanda Hocking, on the other hand, has already made millions from her books. She's looking at people who couldn't get them. You can't find her books in a bookstore. You can get them in hardcover from POD. So she wants to reach new readers. And probably the remaining 65% of book sales that still come from the print. Interestingly, one of the bidders for her rights was a novel entrant, as it were, a partnership between Amazon and Harcourt, where Amazon would deliver to the digital end of the deal and Harcourt the print. Went with St. Martin's anyway. So Amanda's had a very thoughtful approach as well, and she has a great understanding of how she got where she is, the impact of luck, the impact of being good enough, and that her story isn't going to work for everybody equally well. Every case is different. As she says, every author is different. That's true for all of us as well, because opportunities vary tremendously depending on who you are and what you want to do. New value chains always open new opportunities for new players. We hear you all over the place. You hear new straight technology plays. There is a rich ebook vendor of the month, virtually. Tool developers for people to produce enhanced ebooks as well. And new ways to deliver services to authors. I mentioned Smashwords. You have the Story Plan. A guy here before is a new, completely author-focused deal in which they're solely focusing on new authors. So some of the new technical plays are pretty interesting. They have really different approaches. The Elements was one of the first really big selling book apps for the iPad. It was created by a guy named Theo Gray. He wrote a very successful coffee table book about the collection of elements that he amassed with his Mathematica millions. And so he wanted to use his technical abilities to deliver this content in a much richer, more vital format. And he actually has 360-degree rotating videos of all of his pieces of metal and so on. So he wrote software to create an active, multimedia, sort of database-oriented application like this with 114 different elements, as it were. And he's now formed a publisher, and he's brought to market since the success of his initial volume, two more from other authors, one on the solar system, one on gemstones. Al Gore has a new book called Our Choice, and he brought it to the iPad app market again with the help of a technology partner called Push Pop Press. And this is a very slick, very well-produced offering. Everybody who looks at it says, the scrolling is gorgeous, the video, the photograph integration is terrific. But this is much more traditional content. This is page-oriented content. You can see the print down at the bottom. You scroll through it. You go from chapter to chapter. So a completely different kind of work from the Elements. And if we really bust out the creative stuff, we have History of Jazz by a firm called 955 Dreams, which is video, it's music, it's graphical elements, animation, and text about the history of jazz. So you can read about Miles Davis, and you can see video and hear recordings from him at the same time. There's no way that you could deliver this rich an experience through a traditional paper formatted book. And finally, I'll talk about Alice for the iPad, another very early successful book delivered as an app, in which the combination of classic Tenniel illustrations and some new illustrations were given life with the introduction of a physics engine. So you see that watch, it dangles realistically back and forth. There are pages where there's so much animation, it's almost like a game on those pages. Now, this was written by essentially a one-man or a very small shop that then went into the business of producing these books, and they have the original company is Atomic Antelope, which became part of Smashing Ideas. You may have heard Smashing Ideas mentioned a couple of weeks ago when Random House bought them. Excuse me, Bertelsmann AG bought them, the parent company of Random House. So that's the power of the mature organization, by the way. They have the money to drop tens or hundreds of millions of dollars on new providers that they can see leveraging to get into a market. But that's also consolidation in action. Let's look at a completely different way for new providers to add value. This right here, I'm sorry if you can't see the text. It's a page from a highly customized ebook collection of the poems of Yehuda Halevi, which was produced for Next Book by a company named Philidor, a small press that specializes in Judaica. Every page is different. Every page is sized to fit the size of the poem that it offers. The text is arranged carefully for balance and aesthetics. Philidor even designed a brand new Hebrew typeface just for this edition based on the work of Guillaume Le Bay and the Polyglot Bible, which is held to be a landmark of the art of Hebrew type design. I love this example because Philidor isn't a high-tech company. It's a small press. It's got a lot of small press skills. Their typeface design work is one of the most unusual things they do. But it shows that in the turn to digital, you don't need to be a software developer. It doesn't need to drive out the turn to beauty. And how does digital help this? Well, how could you deliver a book where every page is a different size in paper? Wouldn't sit right on the shelf. And how could you afford to design a new typeface unless you could put it on really nice paper so you could tell the difference? And then you'd have a really expensive book for a really small audience. Digital distribution makes this kind of innovation economical. So they're not a tech company, even though they're providing a technical service. This is key because the opportunities that you want to pay attention to are the ones where you can make a difference. So, authors, I know you're in here. Of course you have to know your rights. Where's your backlist? When do your rights revert? There's a very interesting question I'll mention. Let me put on my I am not a lawyer hat. Has a long plume coming out of it. For older works published before the dawn of the ebook age, there was a case. Never quite went to trial to determine whether publishers originally owned ebook rights for things that were published before there were ebooks. It's called Rosetta v. Random House. Rosetta was a very early ebook producer, and they said, "Well, it doesn't say ebooks in the. These authors came to us. We looked at these authors. They don't have ebook in their contract. So how could you have the rights?" And Random House says, "When we say we publish something in ebook in book form, well, that meant ebook. And unfortunately, this was never settled. So the two parties." Came to a settlement that did not resolve the legal question of whether Random House was right or Rosetta was right. So this is something that authors need to pay attention to, particularly if you've been in the market for a while. Who owns your rights? How do you get your rights to revert? Are you getting the best return on your material? And if you're a new author, what's most valuable to you? Because if you want the end cap at Barnes & Noble, well, Amazon's not going to get that for you with the Kindle. Agents. Step back out of the matrix, come back into the publishing world. So take care with contracts, because very subtle differences have started cropping up in new author agreements that affect who owns the rights and how much and what rights are conveyed. You know, if you're an agent, you're helping the author find the best return. That's what your existing business model helps you do. May find the best return for the author, however the work gets published. Very interestingly, though, recently, 2 weeks ago, Publishers Weekly reported the UK-based agency Ed Victor had launched its own ebook and POD publishing arm, print-on-demand publishing arm called Bedford Square Books. And they were launching with half a dozen of their clients' backlist books. Andrew Wiley tried a similar move last year. Now, other agencies appear to be considering similar moves. So that's agent as publisher, a completely different model, possibly fraught with conflict, possibly the way that agents have to act in order to do the best for their clients. So one of the things that makes this happen, of course, is how slight the hard technical barriers are, how low the barriers are to entry to become a publisher. You can deliver print, you can deliver digital, without owning any presses or big typesetting shops. Things always go both ways, though. I read in Future Book, which is a European book publishing blog, Random House had negotiated directly with Tom Sharp, who is a hysterical English humor writer, for his backlist digital rights, bypassing his agent. So that's how everyone is trying to figure out which way things are going. Technologists, there's a new ebook of the month, rich ebook vendor of the month publication. Those are currently produced and sold on almost a consulting model. Or Al Gore hires Push Pop Press. Other players do one off or two off or three off. There's no real common technology basis to deliver really the ebook application, which goes into the App Store. as opposed to the enhanced ebook. Tools aren't great for enhanced ebooks either, with EPUB 3 just coming out now. I think there's a big discoverability problem with the App Store today with regard to books. How do you, if you love a rich ebook by your favorite author, how do you find the other one? It's not easy. Apple's App Store is not designed for books. So if there's a discoverability problem, there's got to be a discoverability opportunity as well. Publishers, you have to know your rights. I'm sure you're already on that, but the very, very interesting point is, how do you manage the P&Ls for ebooks versus the print books by the same author? Are ebooks a different division? Do you have a digital division that's competing with the print division for sales? Maybe maybe the best return on a title, on the rights for that title, might be to consolidate those P&Ls. I've been hearing today that's just something that's under consideration, but isn't there yet. The price competitiveness issue is not going to go away. Would you make more money per title as opposed to per reader at a lower price entry point? Are those higher price points going to survive as more and more enters the market? And of course, there's the specter of, since all of the virtually all of the ebooks published by publishers since the flexible pricing entered have the same price. There's an explicit competitiveness issue as well. If you're building a digital vision, do you build it? Do you buy it? Do you outsource? You probably can't buy a bunch of digital experience in one company and bring it in-house and talk to it through your traditional publishing agency. You're going to need people who are invested in your organization, who are committed to your organization, who are familiar with the digital world, who can talk to and manage those people. Overall, if your authors can sell their ebooks better than you can, you're missing an enormous opportunity to leverage the power and resources you have at your disposal as a mature organization. But no matter who you are, you alone are responsible for predicting your own art. Nobody's going to catch the ball for you. So where do you want to go? And how are you going to get there?